Maya Nandi when she wrote a book about the Asian youth movement. What I did with the archive was go into it and look at the deportation stories. It was interesting in that I was re-engaging with things I'd been involved in as a member of the Asian youth movement. So it was particularly telling the story of Manchester's Asian youth movement and its involvement largely with deportation cases. So many of the other movements were much more concerned with racist attacks, police violence, resisting fascism. And these pictures come from that that collection. So they are available digitally. I'm going to refer to my notes a bit because I'm kind of trying to get quite a lot into in quite a short time. I'm used to the luxury of kind of speaking for a bit longer, so you'll have to forgive me if I start speeding up. But I suppose my personal story starts about growing up in a country where I thought I was the same as everybody else and discovering I wasn't and starting to read and find out about that. And my first kind of journey through that was understanding Black America and the civil rights movement, because those are the things I could access. So when I moved to Manchester, I kind of discovered this group of movements in a kebab shop about 12 o'clock at night. So I was involved a bit with left politics, and I met these bunch of people who were in the Asian youth movement and said, oh, that sounds interesting, I'll come along and see what's going on. Little knowing they were going to dump me with being chair of it very soon. So that context was a strange one in terms of what we experience now. It feels incredibly difficult, the kind of activism that's needed now compared to then. So there were threats from the state. We'd had the 1971 Immigration Act to stop primary migration. We had the activities of the National Front on the street, and we had a Thatcher government that came in to bring in the Nationality Act and restrict immigration controls further. But the kind of apparatus of the state that controlled us was possible to resist it in ways that it's not so possible now. So the kind of resistance that we built was very much about mobilising communities, mobilising a community voice. We had the benefit of being able to get advocates from MPs, so the MP's voice to the Home Secretary had some influence. Councils, trade councils, trade union groups were strong, faith groups were active, and we had access to the judiciary through the appeals process. All of those things have kind of gone now in the world we're living in. And I think the way we would build a campaign was by engaging directly and telling the story. And I think the Steve Cohen archive here shows perhaps why it happened in Manchester more than in other places. Because Steve Cohen worked at the South Manchester Law Centre and was a barrister who fought immigration campaigns. And that lined up nicely with political action alongside those campaigns. So we would kind of get together a story, and the images that are going off are showing. So do you want to put it on the show?
I'm trying to get it to do that. Just struggling. Sorry.
Okay. And whilst the images are largely about kind of Asian families, this was quite inclusive. So the campaigns included African, Caribbean, a guy from Chile I remember particularly because we had really good music on the benefits for him. And we very much focused on telling those stories. So it was easy to tell the stories. I think this is, again, a challenge for now as well as then. It's easy to tell the stories of families and divided families and the need for parenting. And those stories are kind of, we could create empathy in the community, we could create empathy with the media and so on, and those stories would be publicised. But when we come to cases around criminality and the deportation of criminals, when we come to cases about single people who may be seen as economic migrants, those stories were harder to get that kind of empathy. I think I wanted to reflect on some of the challenges we faced as well. So one of the things that we appeared to become was, rather than being an empathetic political structure that was fighting racism and supporting individuals in their campaigns, we began to be seen as a social service. We began to be seen as somebody for whom people were dependent on, so they would come and ask for a campaign for relatives, and that was quite challenging. And I think state funding was used a lot in that period that undermined the campaign. So I think in Anandi's book, she does quite a good analysis of that. But it stopped being a question of collecting the money to organise a demonstration, to get a coach, to do something, to go down to the Home Office, and simply going to the council and saying, can we have a grant? Can we have a coach there? And that meant we didn't go out and talk to people and mobilise them to attend those events. We became quite complacent. And we lost our connections with community. So it became very much more like a kind of welfare-type service. And I think that had longer-term consequences, because that kind of pot of money coming from the councils meant that other groups became interested. And what we saw over time was that those groups came to be quite faith-based, quite conservative, quite male, and the politics that they engaged in were not in the type of resistance that we were involved in. So I think the Asian youth movement kind of fizzled out on the back of that. Many of them fell falling victims to state funding, but the individual activists moving on into other types of organisations. So this is all the deportees, by the way, in a national march in Manchester in 1985. So I think that's a kind of reflection from me about what was going on. And I think there's a couple of things that come out of that that were different then to now. So in terms of communicating with each other, we didn't have even mobile phones. So we would write to each other. So I'm coming across notes I've written to other people in this archive, which is quite interesting. But we were mobilised by telephone. So just to give you a couple of examples of mobilisations that I was particularly involved in and that I really enjoyed. So one was an appeal. The first one was the Social Security tried to take child benefit from two of the people who are being threatened with deportation in Manchester. So it was, we organised a picket in the snow of the local Social Security office, and nobody would cross, the mail would cross, so the office was shut down and their benefit was reinstated. Now that kind of action, though cold because it was snowing, and though challenging to organise, was incredibly effective. That kind of power is gone. You know, the Social Security doesn't have any post, it post goes to some central place, and the drivers are working for companies that aren't unionised, so they are going to cross picket lines. And you become personally liable in the event of that, as we've seen with the Stance of 15. So that whole mechanism we had is very different. The second example is from one of those women's cases, Manchin, where we organised a picket of the tribunal. So again, that appeals process isn't available, but we got 150 people at the appeal. It was supported by Gurdwaras, who brought in an urn and plugged it in the waiting room and were serving tea and samosas to people. And there was a lot of chanting and singing, there was a drum going, support from women's groups, support from other Asian youth movements, support from the kind of community itself. To the extent that Steve Cohen came downstairs and said, can you just ask them to be quiet because the judge can't hear? And when he read the judgment, it was a kind of validation of what we'd done. It said, clearly Manchin has the support of such a broad community that there is no way that she should be deported. Now, I suppose the question that comes is, how do we build that kind of narrative? I think we have an opportunity, but it's an incredibly different environment now. And I think the key factors in that are the kind of state control and the way that the state has controlled resistance and brought it under its mantle. So it's really, really hard to think about how you might move beyond making a sympathetic case for an individual to developing a kind of collective push to push back, in effect, 30 years of lawmaking against black people in this country. Thank you very much.
Great. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of the same things, but from a slightly different perspective as someone who wasn't around during the Asian youth movements and who grew up in the 90s and early 2000s, in which all talk of Asians and politics was focused around representation. So it was about characters on EastEnders, it was about newsreaders, sometimes it was about MPs, sometimes it was about coverage in the papers, about the lack of Asian athletes, the brief success of Asian musicians, that kind of thing, right? So it was all very muted and not explicitly political, not about social movements, largely about issues of belonging, about being part of the national collective, about Britishness. And in essence, it was a sort of discourse about acceptance by white British society, and that acceptance was based on being respectable, on being good, aspirational, hardworking immigrants. And of course, this works through the elevation of certain individual figures who could be deployed as signs of a functioning meritocratic democracy. And so then when I discovered the Asian youth movement, I was excited by seeing something totally different to that politics of respectability that I'm sure we're all familiar with. So they were militant, confident, self-organised, creative, and not beholden to anyone. I think that that kind of imagery has been like largely suppressed or ignored. And I think that seeing that and kind of discovering that, partly through Ananda Ramamurthy's book that Nigel's talking about, but also through things like the film Hands of Songs, in which there's an interview with the Birmingham Asian Youth Movement. So I think thinking about those archival documents and films from the time where you can see some of this, and I found that I hadn't seen any of those images in anywhere more mainstream. And I've been involved in campaigns and work around detention and deportation since about, I guess, 2004-05. Been involved in student politics around deportation. I volunteered for a kind of questionable NGO, and then was involved in a larger bunch of these, like mostly kind of anarchist-y, no borders style politics in London, campaigning around deportation and detention. And across all of those different kinds of organisations, I found that none of us knew anything really about anything that had come before. So none of us knew anything about the history of anti-deportation campaigns. So then learning about how they functioned within the Asian youth movement was really useful to me. So I think, as Nigel was saying, this idea that you could take a kind of sympathetic family story and try and turn that into a cause and then try and turn that into a wider issue was obviously something that we were doing, but we hadn't really read or heard about any of the other ways that people had done that and the problems that they encountered. And so I was interested in the specific cases that became part of the that part of trying to build that movement. And there was a couple that really stood out to me. So the first one was the case of Baba Baktura in Birmingham. Now he was a Punjabi folk singer and was very much part of the community. He sang at weddings and he sang in the Gurdwara. And he was really well liked, very much part of the community and very much part of our everyday life there. And I was partly reminded of this case because of the attempted deportation a few days ago of the Manchester-based jungle MC, Mad Rush. And he was taken off the deportation flight at the last minute. But I was thinking about the way that the people that are targeted by the deportation regime are musicians and artists and very much the people that produce our kind of collective cultural life. So in Bob Baktura's case, there was the usual drawn-out process of losing in court, appealing, winning the appeal, and then having that appeal overturned. And finally, Baba won in the House of Lords, who rules that the Immigration Appeals Tribunal should take account of his valuable service to the Asian community as a folk singer and charity performer. But that too was then overturned. But I think that's really interesting, the idea that you could appeal on the basis of someone being valuable to the community, when now we're hearing a discourse of the Home Office saying that you can parent your children by Skype. So I think just thinking about that disjuncture, thinking about how much that conversation has kind of generated into these really, like, absolutely inhumane statements. So thinking about the idea that you could say, no, this person's part of our community, and that was something that could get some airtime, I think is really important. And the Birmingham group, in this case, found a really peculiar political loophole that's also been closed up. So they realised that as a Commonwealth citizen, though you didn't have the right of automatic residency in the UK, you did have the right to stand for political office. So they put him up as an independent candidate for a parliamentary seat in the area, and then they used that as a platform to campaign against deportation. So It was probably the safest Labour seat in the country. Papa Voxer got, I think, 300 votes or something, so almost nothing. But it was an incredible opportunity to talk about his case and about deportation more generally. And I just thought that the absolute like, sheer creativity of that campaign was really inspiring to think about. So how can we use sort of the parliamentary system as a vehicle for that kind of publicity? And the Labour candidate who won by really like miles and miles in the pub after the election result was announced wouldn't come and shake the hands of the Asian youth movements or a complex aura. And I think that's really interesting to note, right? So in this moment where it feels like the Labour Party, there are some sympathetic ears in there, and I think there are sympathetic ears, and I think we should make the most of those. But I think that story is a cautionary tale as well, right? So there are some sympathetic ears until they feel like you're on their turf, seems to be one of the messages here. So I think that in our engagements with the Labour Party, it might be instructive to remember that kind of territorialism that the political Labour Party sometimes show. And the other key case that I'd like to talk about a bit that you might well have heard of that was more well known was the case of Anwar Ditta, again in Birmingham. Well, she was born in Birmingham and then she moved to Rochdale. And she was married in 1968 and had three children and that was in Pakistan, and then in 1975 she and her husband decided to return to England. They left their three children in Pakistan while they came back here to find house and some work, and they intended to send for the children as soon as they arrived and were settled. But the Home Office didn't believe that her children were really her children. And they even claimed that there were two Anwar Dittas, one that married her husband in England and one that married her in Pakistan. So this is an idea is really extraordinary. The idea that was more convincing to them that there were two women with the same name that married the same man in different countries than this was just the same woman. Kind of extraordinary, I think. Like, I think when you read judgments on people's cases, when you read those Home Office judgments, when you read those letters, and you hear the ridiculous claims in them, we can see there's a real legacy of that. So they've been making ridiculous claims for decades and decades. So the Asian youth movement supported Anwar and her husband, and she spoke at meetings up and down the country, at student unions, at libraries, trade unions, women's groups. Granada TV made a whole programme about her, which they went to Pakistan and interviewed her children there. And she was eventually reunited with her children, but only after agreeing to an internal medical examination to prove that she had given birth to more than one child. And she described that process as being abused by consent. So just thinking about the position that she was put in there, to have to succumb to this incredibly invasive, violent act on her body, to prove something that was abundantly clear to everyone anyway. So it seems like an act of real cruelty. I think thinking about the immigration regime as one that is based on cruelty, on kind of senseless, violent cruelty, is really important to remember. I think sometimes there's a sense in which when a regime is so enormous, to try and look for logic in it that goes beyond something like cruelty, to try and look for a kind of economic logic or a kind of political logic in it. And there might well be those logics, but there is also something that is just violent about it. I think it's worth kind of thinking about that too. And I found watching videos of Anwar Ditta speaking on YouTube, and you can find them there relatively easily, kind of interesting just to be reminded of her accent, that she's from Rochdale, she's got this forthrightness. You see her marching wearing sari, her presence is really familiar. Like, she feels like lots of women that I know and you probably know too. And a few years ago, I was doing some workshops around immigration rates with a group called Justice for Domestic Workers. It was a really mixed group of women from all over the world. And so many of the women in that group were also separated from their children and also trying to find a way to bring their kids over and be reunited with them. So many of them were conducting so much of their parenting in this horrible, sort of disjunctured way on Skype, in which they felt they were really losing their connections, their ability to mother their children. And thinking about the difficulty in mobilising the community around that for these women, because they were here as domestic workers, and so they were on tied visas, tied to an employer. They had so little time to develop other kinds of relationships, because 7 days a week they were working. Some of them got this Sunday afternoon off to come to this group, Justice for Domestic Workers. So often they couldn't do that. So maybe they'd make it to one or two Sundays in the course of a month. And it's like trying to mobilise when those visa systems have been changed so dramatically, so people are on 6-month visas, and then how do you mobilise, how do you try and do that if you're constantly switching between employers that only ever have 6 months at a time than you? So just thinking about those shifts and those much more draconian laws and that real constant push after that 1971 change to primary purpose rule, trying to see how many more kinds of legislation are making it all the more difficult to settle permanently. And so just thinking about those cases, I felt really shocked by how much more difficult it had become. And finally, I just want to talk very briefly about some of the kind of state responses, which I think Nigel covered really well, so I'll try not to repeat anything. But I think in the first instance, the state's response to the Asian youth movement's campaigning against deportation was to try and sort of ignore it. So Dave Waddington, the Home Office Minister responsible for immigration, stated that anti-deportation campaigns were just a hindrance to the rule of law and the campaigns won't make any difference in his decision to deport black people. So we might see that the language has changed slightly, but this is still effectively what Home Secretary has been saying for decades. After that, there are attempts to really crush the Asian youth movement. So we see the malicious prosecution of the Bradford 12, again on terrorism charges. I think very much worth thinking about the relationship between the charges of the Bradford 12 and the other malicious prosecutions we've seen more recently. Yeah, that image, I think, of Bradford 12 free is one that I think is very compelling. The sense of celebration there is really extraordinary. I think worth returning to those moments of celebration, particularly in like quite difficult times. So I think worth celebrating those moments. But also then, I think that one of the most effective strategies, I think it's been said, was that co-option. So in Alandi's book, she refers to it as buying activists off the street. And that was really effective. And I think thinking about this thing of the council putting on a bust for everyone to go to the deportation hearing is really useful. So quite often we talk in a language of there are grants available, we should apply for the grants, or you know, we should take money, we shouldn't have to fund this ourselves. But actually what you lose if you don't fund it yourself is not just independence, but also people's sense of investment. I think that's really important. Think about the difference in what happens when you go door to door and ask people for money. Is that, yeah, people sometimes they do say no, but actually when they say yes and when they do put their hands in their pocket, you get a different sort of investment. And so I remember putting on a meeting in Whitechapel after there was some big immigration raids there, and we didn't know who would show up, but it was a really kind of usual mix of like the white left and a bunch of scattered other people, and you know, it was always a bit of a strange mix when you put on an event, I think. This one much less strange than usual, I would say. And then a few businessmen from the area came, really like respectable uncles, and at the end they came up and they said, I've written you a cheque and I don't know who to make it out to. And they just wanted to put money in. I think that we shouldn't ignore that. We shouldn't ignore the fact that people actually do. That if we fund those things within our own communities, then there is partly independence, but there's also people's sense of a kind of collective ownership. And so I just think that might also be something for us to all think about. So I will leave it there.
Okay, so we've got maybe 5 minutes to have a couple of questions. If anyone's got anything they're really burning to ask, or would like to comment.
I was very interested in the generational aspects of both of your contributions. So, I'm just trying to pin it down to one specific question, which is, in Manchester, did you have, what was the dynamic between the Asian youth movement and, I don't know if the Indian Workers Association existed in Manchester, maybe not, but maybe something, some equivalent to the activists from an earlier generation that were maybe at a different stage?
It didn't really exist in Manchester. So the question was about kind of that relationship. So that was important to some of the Asian youth movements. And I think in Birmingham particularly, the relationship with the Indian Workers Association was very strong. A lot of the activists had come through the Indian Workers Association and the youth wing and then kind of moved on to thinking about racism and how it operates against different groups and moved beyond the badge of the Indian Workers Association. In Manchester, that wasn't really there. I think it was a more international community. So the kind of the elderly leadership came more, and it wasn't that old, but it was kind of people you wouldn't recognise as youths, I suppose, came more from those people who had been at university and who had come from movements at home, you know, CPIML and those kinds of movements, rather than having an organised body. And I think that's just a reflection of the nature of Manchester settlement. It was much more kind of rural village settlement into mill work and textile work.
What's the CPIML?
So it's the Communist Party of India Marxist-Leninist. So that kind of Marxist-Leninist training. So the Asian Youth Movement, when you look at the archive, has this incredibly Marxist-Leninist kind of structure in terms of minutes and representation and everything else at the bottom of it. It kind of disappears when you actually start talking to young people and mobilising them into it. But at its heart, it had this real strong tradition of that.
I was wondering what it was like, Nigel, looking back at the archive, and what was there, and what was missing? I mean, that's obviously quite a big question.
Okay. I suppose I could piece together what was there, but what was clear from Manchester is we weren't organised very much. So there was these kind of outputs, which were quite kind of heavy reading about what was going on in parts of India and Pakistan at the time. So there was a connection with literature, but as a group we were quite disjointed. We didn't really document things, and I think that's something, you know, I know Anwar Ditta's archive is just coming in, and she was apparently religious about documenting everything she was involved in, and she's been involved in so much over so many years. It will be a fantastic resource. But as a group, we weren't really thinking about history. I think I just had a conversation with someone here who was thinking about, well, what do we do now to capture what it is we're doing? How do we save it so that other people can learn from what we did? Because it feels very much to me like there's a disjoint between what I know and what my son knows. I can give it to him verbally, but there isn't anything he can go to understand that history. And that's within my family.
Could you just explain Luke's work?
Luke has done his research on deportation of foreign criminals to Jamaica, and has been involved very much in kind of recent events. I think he's kind of ridden on the back of that substantive research to comment kind of quite publicly on what's happened to the Williams generation on deportation flights. His visits to Jamaica for his field work have coincided with two kind of big events, I think, are symptomatic of the relationship between this country and those people. The first, he was there when Cameron was there offering a super prison so that we could get over human rights legislation by having a good prison in Jamaica to send foreign criminals to. And the second time he was there with one of the flights that was sent, so we managed to interview a number of people who had just got off the plane, which is kind of quite a frightening experience. So his work is close to where I was, but our understanding of those things has come through dialogue now rather than him having known that as part of his history. So as an activist, if he hadn't actually done that research, he wouldn't have connected with these kind of struggles and the broad range of things they engage with, which are the same in contemporary.
Thanks so much, Nigel Teter. And I think that what you're saying about Anwar Ditta's archive like really demonstrate some of the challenges of this work, because if Anwar had been deported, like her archive would have been lost. There's no way that thing could be handed over. So now we're going to, well, let's thank Nigel. Thank you so much. And now we're going to hand over to Tej, who is the Community Development Officer at the George Padmore Institute. If anyone, there are seats down here if people want to come in.
Come down.
Yeah.